I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
In the United States from the early 60s onwards, the other great dynamo of protest was the civil rights movement.
People get ready, there's a train coming.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
As the 60s progressed, the anti-war movement and the movement for racial equality came closer and closer together.
So it's necessary to down the first of all, because I am sick of the racist war in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United States.
By 1968, just a year before his death, Martin Luther King would declare, "The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities of a decent America. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and declare eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism." Here's Dennis Merrill, Professor of History at the University of Kansas, Missouri.
In addition to questioning, just the war in Vietnam and whether or not it was a practical matter, there was a questioning regarding domestic plagues such as racism. There was, of course, by the mid-1960s, a feminist movement. The National Organization of Women was founded in 1966. And so I think a lot of dissent came bubbling up once some of the basic assumptions of that had defined national identity in Cold War America, came under the microscope.
My complaint about the so-called rebels of the 1960s was not that they reacted against crass materialism, not that they wanted some ideals in their life, but that in their pursuit of those ideals, they behaved in ways which undermined and betrayed a lot of Western values.
For Owen Harries, the culture of protest in the 1960s was a betrayal, what he calls the main betrayal of liberal democracy in the Cold War era.
They wanted direct action. They wanted results quickly. They had no patience with procedures, with the rules of democracy, with the institutions of democracy, things that had been crafted slowly over generations and which were essential to the successful working of a democratic system. So they conducted a series of assaults on the institutions, on the methods of democracy, the sit-ins, the disruption of university lives, and so on. I think Ortega y Gasset made the point about when he says, and Ortega Gasset was writing in the 1920s, but I think it applies very much to the 1960s, when he says, they demanded bread, and their method of making their protest was to burn down the bakery.
No, I don't think so at all. I think very much the contrary. I think what you have in America now, of course, is a concerted attempt to paint the 1960s as an aberration within American culture, and to paint the kind of radical shift that we're undergoing now as a return to normalcy. And of course, this is what the culture wars are about nowadays. In the US, there is still an attempt to put the paste back into the tube, as it were. I mean, I think that's what's at stake in these arguments about 1968 as a betrayal. I think 68 is basically, for me, connected with the civil rights movement. Now, is the civil rights movement a betrayal of American culture, of Jefferson, Thomas Paine, etc.? Certainly not. It is in the best traditions, let's say, of American liberalism, interpreted in a liberal rather than in a restrictive way.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time.
And for me, as a German at the time, what was so important was to learn a lesson about civil disobedience. You know, in a country that had an authoritarian mentality, to understand civil disobedience as part of the practice of democracy was enormously important.
The person who is most American in America is that person who exercises his right to dissent. We oppose the war, understand that.
In Berlin and Berkeley, in Paris and London in 1968, a generation was learning a lesson in civil disobedience. On the other side of the Iron Curtain, in Prague, a 30-year-old writer called Václav Havel published an essay calling for the creation of an opposition party in Czechoslovakia. It was a daring move on Havel's part, but one that was tolerated by the reform communist government of Alexander Dubček. When Havel wasn't writing plays and essays, he was hanging out in bars and listening to rock and roll, in particular to a little-known group from New York called the Velvet Underground. More than 20 years later, after the collapse of communism, Havel would tell the Velvet Underground singer and lyricist Lou Reed, "Because of you, I am president." The story of how the Velvet Underground helped to make the Velvet Revolution is a Cold War parable of cultural subversion. Here's Matt Welsh, associate editor of Reason Online.
It's strange, but acknowledged by Havel himself. Sometime in 1968, while Prague was undergoing this marvelous sort of cultural thawing and flowering that was referred to at the time as Prague Spring, a copy of The Velvet Underground and Nico got into the grubby hands of a couple of musicians. One of them was Milan Hlavsa, who is a bass player. I believe he also played the cello a little bit, for a band called the Plastic People of the Universe. Plastic People of the Universe was very experimental, theatrical, strange, and they took their cues from basically two bands, one, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, who are still incredibly popular all over Central Europe, strangely enough. And then the other one was Velvet Underground and Nico. As Hlavsa explained to me when I met him for the first time in 1991 over a beer or 12, when you listened to John Cale's violin, you knew that the song was against something. If I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man. When I put a spike into my vein, and I tell you things aren't quite the same. When I'm rushing on my run, and I feel just like Jesus' son. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know.
The Velvet Underground weren't your average hippies or protest singers. They sang about heroin and sadomasochism. But to their fans in Prague, it wasn't the words so much as their sound that was so subversive.
They didn't even understand the lyrics. Very few people in Prague spoke English back then. But there was a feeling, a sense of it that was against the sort of mechanization of the time, of people who held power. And so these guys, the Plastic People of the Universe, got hold of the Velvet Underground and Nico. They would play in their shows a bunch of Velvet Underground covers and Frank Zappa covers.
And Václav Havel himself was one of the people who heard the Velvet Underground at the time and heard the Plastic People and was turned on, yeah?
He certainly saw the Plastic People and enjoyed them. They were part of just the basic ferment of the town. Havel, certainly, who was at that point a member of the groundbreaking Theater of the Balustrade down close to the Vltava River, engaging in experimental theater and being a dramaturg, he always had a taste for rock music. And looking back, he has always described himself as very much a creature of the 60s, that was his sort of marvelous, magical time. And unlike people like Bill Clinton, he didn't try to live it down later on when he got into office. He emphasized it as much as possible. It informed who he is. And it informed eventually, as we'll see, his basic dissent.
Oh yeah, this is one of the things that unites East and West really in the 1960s. A huge hunger for experimentation, for breaking out of the cultural straitjacket of the 50s and 60s. And of course, in the East, where the pressures to conform were even stronger in many ways than in the West, that hunger also existed.
And I remember 68 in, the summer of 68 and August 68, which came after the revolts in May, after the big protests in Germany, there was a sense that it was the same issues that were at stake. So in a sense, there was already a kind of 68, a kind of first move toward cultural globalization, which ultimately failed. Which failed in a sort of political sense. It didn't fail necessarily in a sense that it was able to really influence lifestyles everywhere in the world.
The sound of Radio Prague, still broadcasting as Soviet tanks rolled past its studios on August the 21st. Czechoslovakia's experiment with communism with a human face was over.
At 3 a.m. 21st August 1968, I woke up to a completely different world from that one I went to sleep in. At the very moment I am recording this, the Russian tanks, prepared for any action, are standing in a big park just under my windows. You might think that the Czech people behaved like cowards when they did not fight. But you just can't go against the tanks with empty hands. The only way how you can help us is that not to forget Czechoslovakia.
I suppose people like me, very young people and young people then in Poland, were much less interested in what was going on in Paris in May 1968 than what was going on in Prague or what was going on in our country.
For Wojciech Sadurski, a young Polish intellectual at the time, the crushing of the Prague Spring was a sign that the protests in the West in 1968 and the brief flowering of dissent in the East were still a world apart.
I didn't find that what was going on, say, in Paris or Berkeley in 1968, and on the other hand, in Prague and Warsaw in 1968, were parts of the same movement, of the same broad phenomenon. These things didn't resonate with each other. I mean, we were all living in prisons, even though some of these prisons were less punitive than others, and we had an obvious enemy, and that was the oppressive bureaucratic state with its secret police. And therefore, for us, such a violent, such a strong movement against governments which, after all, from our perspective, were democratic, were constitutional, were respecting the rule of law, was something which we didn't understand, and most of us did not appreciate, I would say.
Když je dnes člověku 20.
The years after the crushing of the Prague Spring were years of political and cultural repression in Eastern Europe. But there's a golden thread which leads from the events of 1968 to one of the most important developments of the 70s in Eastern Europe, the emergence of citizens' movements and groups such as Solidarity in Poland. And perhaps it's more accurate to say that it's a velvet thread or a plastic one. In 1976, the Plastic People of the Universe were arrested and imprisoned on a charge of disturbing the peace. The trial of the rock band would be the catalyst for the creation of one of Eastern Europe's most influential dissident groups, Charter 77. Matt Welsh.
Well, think about this. The creation of Charter 77, which is Havel's crowning achievement of dissidence in addition to his writing at the time, it was started basically in 1976 after four members of the Plastic People of the Universe were arrested for disturbing the peace, which was sort of a catch-all Czech law, very Kafka-esque, where if they just didn't like the looks of you, they'd haul you off to jail. Interestingly, Havel saw that as the time to draw a line in the sand. Havel said, you know what? This is exactly an attack on an underground like this is an attack on, as he wrote, a most elementary and important thing, something that in fact bound everyone together. It was an attack on the very notion of living within the truth on the real aims of life.
The trial of the plastic people of the universe inspired Václav Havel to write his most famous political essay, The Power of the Powerless.
Their trial was not a confrontation of two differing political forces or conceptions, but two differing conceptions of life. On the one hand, there was the sterile puritanism of the post-totalitarian establishment, and on the other hand, unknown young people who wanted no more than to be able to live within the truth, to play the music they enjoyed, to sing songs that were relevant to their lives, and to live freely in dignity and partnership.
The trial also moved Havel and some colleagues to set up Charter 77.
All they did was they tried to get the communist government, which was a co-signatory to the Helsinki Agreement, they tried to get them to live up to the words of the Helsinki Agreement. They weren't agitating for specific political aims, necessarily, although, of course, they were political. They weren't agitating or creating a political party. They were just saying, live up to what you have legally signed yourself up for, and we are going to openly petition and collect signatures from this cowed population and wave it around in your face and make it public in the West as well for you to live up to your obligations. And this all sprang from the trial of four rock musicians.
The founding of Charter 77 and Havel's essay on the power of the powerless both combined to open up a crack in the seemingly impervious edifice of the communist state. Zbigniew Buzak, who was a solidarity activist on the factory floor in the late 1970s, would say later, "When I look at the victories of solidarity and of Charter 77, I see in them an astonishing fulfillment of the prophecies and knowledge contained in Havel's essay." Across Eastern Europe, a generation of activists opened up a new front in the ideological civil war within communism. Martin Krieg here.
And so they started a strategy which Havel called the power of the powerless, Hungarian George Conrad calls apolitical politics, and in Poland it often had as its slogan civil society. They asked themselves, or a number of them wrote this, what is it that normal societies, by which they mean Western societies, meant Western societies, what is it that they have that we don't have? They have societies where people can do apolitical things. They don't have to ask to set up a jazz club, a stamp collectors club. They don't have to get permission to go somewhere, to have a meeting in the house. They don't, if they have common interests, need to ask anyone. And that's what we're not going to do now. We will behave. This was wonderfully captured in a phrase of Timothy Garton Ash, who knew this situation very well. He said, the new policy was to live as if they were in a normal society. That meant not political contestation, so in that sense, that's not what it was about, but an attempt to generate social bonds. But secondly, it would be a kind of gesture to politics, that this is something you don't control. Communists maybe knew better than we credited them with, that their structure had this peculiar vulnerability. When the system ceased to be able to control people who thumbed their noses up at it, I think that had an enormous effect. I remember reading when Lech Wałęsa, the great union leader, became that union leader in August 1980, spoke, and he was interviewed in the press. And I remember this testimony from person after person. We were hearing for the first time in public people saying very ordinary, true things.
Thank you. You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National and the first episode of our special series, Torn Curtain, The Secret History of the Cold War. Technical production today is by Judy Rapley and the original music is by Stuart Brown. And if you'd like to join in the Cold War battle of ideas, please leave us a comment in the Hindsight guestbook. There are transcripts on our homepage too. Next week, Spies, Secrets and Australia's Bid for the Bomb, a real-life thriller from the early years of the Cold War. I'm Tom Morton, and stay with us now on ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.